Welcome to the Sandwell News, due to be with you through your letterbox and on the internet on December the 13th.
Sunrise this week will be at 8:15, sunset at 5 to 4. Temperatures at the start of the week will be a bit cooler, around 7 degrees Celsius.
Some headlines from this week's Express and Star. Wednesday's news: horses are back in the police force. Local legend closing his bookshop after 64 years. Remembering the bunny hug cult of the 1950s. Thursday's news: food banks said to be handing out food parcels every 10 seconds. More GP appointments being made using online systems. More than 76,000 want airport named after Aussie. New dog mince pies from Aldi. Friday's news: good news for travellers as rail strike called off. A brief history of German markets. Saturday's news: rip back in time to a world of exciting and happy times. Peaky Blinders has its eye on locations for new series. Monday's news: Mason frustrated at Albion's passive performance and 3-1 defeat at QPR. Better bus and services after financial boost. Online system unfair to many, including pensioners. Tuesday's news: West Bromwich MP calls again for crackdown on illegal ghost plates. Ticket fraudsters target Santa Train event.
Yes, indeed, there's quite a bit of that sort of thing about, and those are a few of the stories coming up in this edition, courtesy of Express and Star Publications. And with the usual run of items, including a rather longer than usual listing of what's on TV and radio. Now, before we get into the main week's news, here's a quick announcement from the council about a panto. Oh yes, it's a panto coming up in the near future.
Sleeping Beauty at West Bromwich Town Hall this Christmas. Families are invited to enjoy a magical, musical, festive performance of Sleeping Beauty at West Bromwich Town Hall from Friday 19th December through to Tuesday 23rd December. Our newly improved West Bromwich Town Hall opens its doors for touring pantos to deliver more family entertainment after the success of their performances last year. This time we have more dates and more seats, providing more room for laughter and loved ones. Join Chester the Jester, King Arthur the Clever and Queen Christina to celebrate the birth of their first child, Aurora. Dame Dropalot is doing the cooking, Fairy Charity and the Sprite. Peter the Pure are looking after Aurora. And all is well except nobody invited Maleficent the Evil. This is a gripping traditional tale of romance, comedy, and good versus evil, brought up to date with a well-crafted script and original songs written by Jerry Graham, comedy, dance, some unexpected twists and turns, and a generous helping of audience involvement. Whether you are a panto regular or are interested in experiencing your first panto, Sleeping Beauty is a must-see, and we highly recommend joining us for such an incredible production. The countdown has begun. Spread the word and book your tickets now. Book your tickets now at Ticketsource. www.ticketsource.co.uk. What's on? West, Midlands, West Bromwich, Town Hall, Christmas Pantomime, Sleeping Beauty, Ijimi. Friday 19th December 2025, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Saturday 20th December 2025, 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. and 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Sunday, 21st December 2025, 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. Monday, 22nd December 2025, 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. Tuesday, 23rd December 2025, 2 p.m. to 4 p.m.
Hello everyone, my name's Mia, and today I'm going to be reading some newspaper articles for you from the 3rd of December in the Express and Star. I hope everyone is well. As I'm recording this to you today, there are officially 18 days till Christmas. Is everyone excited? Has everyone got their decorations up? Either way, I hope everyone's enjoying this time of year. I myself am enjoying opening my advent calendar every day, just to see kind of what surprise I get. Let's begin. Plans for mini service station next to M5 are given approval. Plans have been approved to build a new mini service station next to the M5 in West Bromwich. The new units and electric vehicle charging points would be built next to the Kaizen, formerly Intersection House, adjacent to the M5 in West Bromwich. The plans include 4 new commercial units, with 3 measuring 1,200 square feet, and another larger unit measuring around 4,000 square feet. The applicant, Beyond Island, requested the units are Class E, which includes shops, restaurants, bars, offices, and gyms, and other commercial buildings. A 32-space car park has also been included. Sandwell Council's planners said they would have preferred to see the units built in West Bromwich High Street, Assel Retail Park, or the town's New Square Shopping Centre, in a bid to protect the town centre's viability, but those locations were later ruled out as unsuitable by the applicant. A report by Sandwell Council outlining the approval said, "The principle of development contradicts policies in council planning documents, as well as the vision and objectives in the West Bromwich Master Plan. However, the electric vehicle chargers element is a key consideration. Whilst out-of-town centres are discouraged, the planner's opinion is that the out-of-centre provides a much-needed mini-service station, allowing rapid charging facilities on-site that aids providing additional electric vehicles charging points along the highway network, and in particular, close proximity to the M5. This is a moment in history, as horses are back in the police force. Mounted unit, a massive boost for neighbourhood policing and public engagement. For the first time in 26 years, police horses are back in the West Midlands due to an operational decision made by Chief Constable Craig Guildford. After months of planning, specialist advice and trials using other force horses at local football matches over the past 2 years, West Midlands Police's new horses have started patrolling the region's streets. Throughout this week, the first horses to join West Midlands Police's new mounted unit will be visiting every borough in the region. Belgravia, Bruce, Yonkers, Eve and Yvonne arrived in the West Midlands on Monday, November 24th, 2025. And after a week of settling into their new home, they started their official policing duties with riders Sergeant Hadley and PCs Dixie, Masterson, Priest, Pritchard and Smith on Monday, December 1st, 2025. The horses will be stabled at the force's Tally Ho site in Edgbaston, Birmingham, and serve the entire West Midlands and even other police forces if needed. They will have access to grazing, specialist vets, and everything else they need for a happy, healthy working life. Assistant Chief Constable Mike O'Hara from the force's executive team is leading on the project to return horses to the force. He said, "This is a moment in history for West Midlands Police, as we once again welcome horses back into the force. We have been working on this project for over a year, and the plans have been carefully considered. We are confident that our mounted unit will generate income from loaning the horses to other forces, and in support of this work, we're also exploring sponsorship options that could help cover food and other expenses. New jobs for both police officers and police staff have been created as part of the plans, including an apprentice groom. We are really grateful for the help and advice from the World Horse Welfare Charity, which has helped us to ensure that our working animals will be well cared for right from the start. The return of horses is great news for the communities we serve, as the mounted unit will be a massive boost for neighbourhood policing and public engagement." Police and Crime Commissioner Simon Foster said, "I am delighted to welcome back West Midlands Police's dedicated mounted unit as horses return to the region on a full-time basis for the first time since 1999. The horses will contribute to my priorities of building community policing and trust and confidence," he added. "Not only will new jobs be created, but the support of police horses in relation to crowd management will ensure highly skilled officers can be assigned to other roles." I echo ACC O'Hara's comments that this is a moment in history for West Midlands Police, and I'm looking forward to welcoming the new horses. We have worked with other police forces who also have mounted units to secure 5 healthy horses that have the right training and temperament for policing in the busy West Midlands. 9 other horses have been identified and are currently undergoing extensive health checks before moving to the West Midlands. 6 officers have already graduated from an intensive 16-week course in London. 3 others are currently undertaking the training course, and 2 other officers are transferring from other police forces, with further roles due to be advertised in the new year. Council ranked among top 3 in the Midlands for fixing potholes. Road workers at a Black Country Council are among the best in the country for pothole and carriageway repairs, a survey suggests. Sandwell Council is among those leading the way in maintaining roads and tackling potholes, according to the latest National Highways and Transport, NHT, Public Satisfaction Survey. The borough also features in the top 10 nationally for key highway maintenance measures. It is 4th nationally for repair standards, 7th for the number of potholes fixed, and 8th nationally for the condition of road markings. In the West Midlands, the council ranks best for 5 separate highway maintenance measures, demonstrating consistent performance across the borough. In a separate survey supported by MEL Research, resident satisfaction with road maintenance in Sandwell is more than double the national local government benchmark. To further improve efficiency, Sandwell has invested in innovative machinery, including the multi-hog machine, which allows the council to prepare road surfaces quickly for repairs when potholes do appear, reducing the need for temporary fixes. Sandwell's highway boss, Councillor Keith Olcock, said, "We are proud that Sandwell is recognised nationally for the outstanding condition of our roads. This achievement reflects years of consistent investment, smart planning, and a commitment to do things the right way. Not only are we one of the top performers in the country for overall road condition, but we're also leading the way in the speed, quality, and reliability of our pothole repairs. What makes this even more impressive is that we deliver all of this while remaining highly efficient and keeping the cost per mile exceptionally low. Through the use of innovative technology, data-led maintenance, and forward-thinking repair methods, we're able to make every pound go further. Potholes often form when water seeps into small cracks in the road surface and expands when frozen, eventually causing the surface to break up. The council tackles this by sealing the cracks early, applying protective surface covering, and using a proactive maintenance programme to extend a road's lifespan. The NHT Public Satisfaction Survey collects public perspectives on and satisfaction with highway and transport services in council areas. The collaboration between highway and authorities enables comparison, knowledge sharing, and the potential to improve efficiencies. Local legend to close his bookshop after 64 years. Black Country legend John Sparry is closing his famous bookshop after 64 years, blaming the rising cost of insurance. John Sparry, who is in his mid-80s, first started selling books from the front room of his cottage in Walheath near Dudley in 1961. John, who became known around the world for his old-fashioned lifestyle, said that once planning permission was secured, he would be returning the home his grandparents bought for in 1910 for £116 to its original state. A well-known raconteur, jazz musician and historian, John used to make regular appearances on BBC Radio 4 talking about his interesting life. He still lives in the same house where he spent his childhood, which has changed little since the 1940s. Concessions to modernity include an electric kettle and mobile phone. But he has never owned a television and continues to cook his meals on an open fire. The house is the same as it was when it was built in the 1860s, apart from a lean-to kitchen which was added at the time of the First World War, he says. I tried watching television once and it gave me a headache. I tried driving once and I crashed. I'm happy living a simple life. Back in the 60s, when the spotlight was firmly on the Beatles, Twiggy and swinging London, John was known as Johnny the Junkman, scratching a living by wheeling a pram around the village collecting old books, rags and any other household junk that he might be able to make a few bob out of. John, one of the leading authorities on Wall Heath's role in the gunpowder plot, said he hoped to continue giving his local history talks and writing books about the characters of the Black Country and surrounding areas. For some time, my talks have been subsiding in the bookshop, he says. I've still got a couple of books I want to write, and Phil Hayes, who keeps the bike shop across the road, says he will keep one or two pieces for me. It's hard for small businesses at the moment. The main things are the energy bills and the insurance. It's the insurance which has really swung it for me. John says he had already sold some of his books at auction and plans to carry on selling his own books through that decidedly 21st century medium, the internet, although he has somebody else to manage his website. His current books include Notable People, about some of the lesser known but interesting characters of the Black Country, Crazy Rhythm, about the jazz legends who played at the Trumpet Pub in Bilston, and They All Were, and Hello Stourbridge, King Edwards. G60J Calling, Come In Please, which looked back at some of the people who attended his old school. When queues of youngsters fell prey to the bunny hug cult. Complaints from parents over the dance floor antics spawned by 1950s craze. There were a 1950s young generation whose antics on the dance floor were worrying their parents and allegedly causing traditional ballroom dancers to boycott local dance halls. Craze of the moment was the bunny hug, a type of hold used by teenagers during waltzes, slow foxtrots and other slow step dances. It got worse. They liked to let themselves go, flinging around the floor to a flying samba or jerking to a jitterbug. Victor Sylvester was not for them. They danced to the sounds of popular Wolverhampton dance band leader Jack Andrews, whose music was laced with Latin American rhythms. Back in 1956, a Wolverhampton Chronicle reporter and photographer was sent along to investigate what the paper described as the newest cult of the 20th century, with their findings published in a spread on May the 4th. For some reason, the venue, it was in Stafford Street, was not revealed, but it was widely popular, regularly being packed out, leaving dozens outside hoping to get in. When it came to adult complaints, there were plenty. It's disgusting, this slothful teenage set, declared a local teacher. No good ever comes out of dance hall lounges. Today's young people are sloppy and aimless, said one parent, who bemoaned the way they shuffled around. Another said young people should find the right time and place to do their courting and should bring back the magic of dancing by at least knowing what foot to put forward for the waltz, the foxtrot and the tango. The Chronicle said no alcohol was allowed on the premises and there was strict police supervision at the entrance. The reporter put the complaints to Mr. Andrews. I strongly disagree with the teenagers kissing and cuddling on the floor. As soon as a girl gets that glassy look in her eyes, she's out as far as I'm concerned, he said. He put forward a possible reason why there was a hug-me-tight look on the dance floor. Invariably, after the interval, we start a non-stop session of about 8 dances. That means a lot of youngsters don't leave the floor. He explained that a few bars of waltz tempo form the break between the non-stop dance session, and probably that was when teenagers began to feel dreamy and dewy-eyed, clinging and clutching. But it doesn't go on all the time. As you can see from the picture, it was a YMCA building which hosted various activities, including snooker, table tennis and boxing, while the poster advertises dancing there on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Saturdays. One of the direction signs points to the canteen around the corner in Little Lanes. If the older generation thought things were going downhill then, they were about to get a shock, because the teenage revolution was underway. Nowhere does the report mention rock and roll, or Elvis, let alone the Teddy Boys, all of which were already making their influence felt.
This is Jan Lloyd, reading articles from the Express and Star on the 4th of December. Food banks likely to hand out emergency winter parcels every 10 seconds. An emergency food parcel will be provided every 10 seconds across the UK this winter, the Trussell charity has predicted. The food bank organisation, which has several groups set up across the West Midlands, said rising costs of essentials such as food, electricity and rent are pushing more families to the brink. It said there were 740,000 emergency food parcels distributed across the UK between December 2024 and February this year, adding that this was 40% higher than pre-pandemic levels 5 years ago. Around one in three, 266,000, parcels handed out last winter went to children, representing a 29% rise compared to the period of December 2019 to February 2020. Parcels delivered to those aged 65 tripled to more than 24,000, Trussell said. There were more than 68,000 families who were first-time food bank users last winter, and Trussell said it expects more this year. Its forecast of one parcel every 10 seconds between this month and February is based on long-term patterns in food parcel distribution by food banks in the Trussell community, the charity said. Its winter campaign is being supported by Hollywood actor Joseph Fiennes, who spoke of the stark reality of how the cost of living continues to affect people's lives. He added, "As winter sets in, we have a responsibility to support people who are struggling most." Former Countdown presenter Carol Vorderman recalled the abject poverty in which she grew up, saying that hardship stays with you, as she also lent her support. She added, "This year, too many people will spend the festive period worried sick, skipping meals so their children can eat, and unsure how they will cope. It doesn't have to be that way, and together we can call for change to end the need for food banks. But until then, food banks remain a lifeline for people struggling to put food on the table." A government spokesperson said it is committing to tackle poverty, adding, "Food bank use is a blight on the country, and although it went down last year, we are determined to do more. To help with the everyday costs, we've increased the national minimum wage, meaning an extra £1,500 a year for full-time workers, as well as taking £150 off energy bills from April and recommitting to the triple lock. Thanks to our decision to scrap the two-child limit and introduce a wider package of measures for families, we will lift 550,000 children out of poverty by the end of this Parliament." Teen masked robber jailed for crime spree. A Tipton teenage armed robber has been jailed after going on an astonishing crime spree, stealing cars at knife point and assaulting people. Now 19, the robber, who cannot be named for legal reasons, wore a balaclava during most of his robberies as he targeted Audi and Range Rovers. It is unknown how many cars the teenager stole before finally being arrested whilst being wanted in the spring of this year. Between 16 and 18, the teenager carried out numerous robberies in Tipton and Wensbury. He would go out with a balaclava or mask and knife and wait for high-performance cars for the owners to return and then rob them. He also joined a gang of car thieves who were involved in home invasions to steal car keys of the homeowners. After turning 18, he embarked on another series of crimes this year, which ultimately would lead to him being put behind bars. In February, he stole a Toyota and a Mondeo, as well as stealing a woman's handbag and helping himself to the contents. Arrested and charged with robbery for the first time, whilst on bail this April, he stole a Range Rover Discovery and then, filling it up with petrol on Wensbury Oak Road, driving off without paying. The teenager's crime spree finally ended when he was arrested in April and remanded in youth custody. Now 19, the robber pleaded guilty at Wolverhampton Crown Court to several robberies, assault with intent to rob, several attempted robberies, handling stolen goods and a series of thefts, and was jailed for 4 years and 3 months. More GP appointments made on online system. A shift away from phone calls concerns pensioner charities by Jane Kirby. And this is an article accompanied by a photograph of a doctor taking someone's blood pressure in their surgery. A higher proportion of people are now contacting their GP surgery online than on the phone, data suggests. The Office for National Statistics Health Experience Survey data for England covering September the 16th to October the 8th shows that 14.6% of people last contacted their GP in person, 40.5% did so on the phone, and 43.3% did so online. In the previous month, covering August the 19th to September the 10th, 14.7% of people last contacted their GP surgery in person, 41.3% did so on the phone, and 42.3% did so online. Online contact includes through the GP practice website or via an app, including the NHS app. From the 1st of October, the government has forced all GP practices in England to offer online booking systems during the core hours of 8:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday to Friday. According to the Department of Health, nearly all GP practices, 98.7% across England, have now rolled out these online consultation requests. It added that a record 8 million online requests were submitted by patients in October, up a fifth of the previous month and an increase of two-thirds on the last year. The British Medical Association, the BMA, is in formal dispute with the government over the changes which it says puts patients at risk. They've also proved unpopular with many people who prefer to be able to phone for an appointment, especially those who are elderly or who may not be online. It is an issue that has been taken up by Age UK, which says online and phone systems can be confusing. Its charity director, Caroline Abraham, said Age UK continues to hear from older people who are struggling and failing to access their GP, primarily because they find it impossible to navigate their surgery's online or telephone-based contact mechanisms. Face-to-face GP appointments often only become available once a patient has been processed through a telephone or internet-based system of triage. The risk for some older people, especially if they are offline or have hearing or cognitive impairments, is that they never get as far as being offered the opportunity to see a doctor because they fall at the first hurdle of getting into and through their surgery's initial triage process. It is crucial we ensure that the triage systems in GP practices do not inadvertently become impenetrable barriers for some older people who want and need to see a doctor. Health Secretary Wes Streeting said, "In the 21st century, patients expect to be able to manage healthcare at their fingertips, and so they should. We organise so much of our lives online, there is no reason the NHS should be different. I want to thank GPs and their teams for rolling this out." 8 million patients used online access in October alone, taking advantage of the flexibility and the convenience. These numbers show there was a huge appetite from patients and a can-do attitude from GPs. "We promised to end the 8 a.m. scramble, and this is a massive step towards that ambition. After more than a decade of decline, we are bringing our analogue NHS into the digital age." Dr. Amanda Doyle, NHS England National Director for Primary Care and Community Service, said, "We are making it easier than ever for people to get the care they need from their GP team. More than 8 million patients used online consultation services last month alone." Dr. David Wrigley, Deputy Chair of the BMA's General Practice Committee for England, said, "We are not standing in the way of progress, but is standing up for patient safety, as many GP practices are being deluged with online requests and the software simply does not filter out routine from urgent requests. GPs will embrace new technology, but only when it is safe to do so, with nearly all GP practices now offering online access for patients. The government has merely increased the potential for patient safety issues to arise. Without appropriate safeguards, this government is ignoring the very concerns that GPs have about this system, and it is putting patients at risk of harm." More than 76,000 support renaming airport after Aussie, by Kirsty Louise Card. More than 76,000 people have signed a petition to rename Birmingham Airport after heavy metal legend Ozzy Osbourne. And Kelly Osbourne, the 41-year-old daughter of Aston-born Black Sabbath frontman Ozzy, has backed the call for the airport to be renamed Ozzy Osbourne International. Her father passed away on July the 22nd, aged 76, just weeks after his final performance at Villa Park. As of last night, 76,400 people had signed the viral petition on change.org to preserve the legacy of the most important musician ever to hail from Birmingham. The petitioners say Ozzy's influence on music and culture is undeniable. Naming our international airport after him would be a fitting tribute to his extraordinary career and contributions to the arts. Other airports in the UK are named after their famous children. George Best International Airport in Belfast, John Lennon Airport in Liverpool. So it's only right that we do this here in Birmingham, in honour of Ozzy. Together, we can celebrate the legacy of Ozzy Osbourne and the incredible influence our city has had on the world stage, thanks to him. In a BBC WM radio interview yesterday, host Ed James asked Kelly whether she agrees with the viral petition to rename her airport, to which she replied, "Absolutely." But she quickly realised her mistake and apologised for swearing live on the BBC, adding, "Oh my God, sorry, I'm on the radio. Sorry, 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 sorry." The presenter was heard laughing as he apologised on her behalf. "We apologise for the language," he said, before half-jokingly asking, "If you had to answer that again without a swear word in it, what would your answer be?" "Yes," she said, in the clip that has gained more than 400 likes on Instagram. Fans immediately took to the comments, praising Kelly for being so much like her father, one user saying, "Chip off the old block, Kelly." Another added, "We love Kelly and all the Osbournes," while a third wrote, "Love it." Kelly Osbourne shared an emotional tribute to her father on social media before appearing on the show yesterday morning on what would have been his 77th birthday. Born John Michael Osbourne on December the 3rd, 1948, in Aston, Birmingham, he rose from humble beginnings to become known worldwide as the Prince of Darkness. From his early years working odd jobs to forming Black Sabbath with school friend Geezer Butler, he helped create one of the most influential and successful metal bands of all time, selling more than 75 million albums worldwide. His loss was felt far and wide, but especially in his home city. Birmingham Airport has been approached for comment. The article is accompanied by a photograph of Birmingham Airport with a slogan put across the front that says, "Ozzy Osbourne Airport." New Dog Mince Pies has pups lining up for a festive taste. This Christmas, Aldi is making tails wag across the nation as it announces its brand new dog mince pies, £4.99 for a four-pack. In a scene that could only be described as positively adorable, a queue of four-legged friends was spotted queuing outside the supermarket's Hinckley store. Aldi's dog mince pies will be available to buy in stores from December the 11th, offering a savoury twist on the classic fruity flavour. Each pie is topped with a mini bone dog treat, ensuring pet parents don't get them confused. Following a surge in pet parents admitting they love spoiling their canine companions over the Christmas period, Aldi is making sure beloved pooches can join in the festive feasting. But pet owners will need to pounce if they want to get their hands on these festive doggy treats, because as with all Aldi special buys, once they're gone, they're gone. Aldi's dog mince pies will be available in store from the 11th of December while stocks last. Meanwhile, Morrisons is helping shoppers get ahead on planning for the big day and spreading the cost of the festive season with its impressive Christmas frozen dinner range. Customers can stock their freezer with all the essentials for the long-awaited Christmas dinner roast, as well as mouth-watering party food and show-stopping desserts. Hosts can pick up crowd-pleasing mains, including the best beef Wellington for £30, or a more traditional option, the small turkey crown, 1.5 to 1.99 kilograms for £17, and simply pop it in the freezer to be used on the day. New to the frozen range this year, the Best Chipolata Pig in Blanket for £3.50 offers a different take on the Christmas staple and is bound to impress both with its size and delicious taste. It is not a Christmas dinner without the selection of popular trimmings, and this year Morrison's has launched several new frozen products on a £2 for £4 promotion, including the Best Cauliflower Cheese, the Best Red Cabbage and the Best Roasted Chardonnay Carrots. For a twist on a classic, try the Best Sprouts with West Country Butter and Pancetta, or arguably, the star of the show, the Best Roast Potatoes with Goose Fat, guaranteed to be crisp up perfectly while keeping a soft, pillowy interior. Again, all are freezer ready. Morrison's frozen range also offers a wide range of delectable desserts, which, if bought now and popped into the freezer, will keep perfectly for those festive hosting moments. Try the Best Tiramisu Pavlova Wreath for £7, a great alternative to the classic Christmas pudding. Or the Best Winterberry and Mascarpone Cheesecake for £5, another new festive addition that will impress friends and family. Morrison's frozen Christmas range is available in all stores nationwide and online now. And this article is accompanied by a photograph of a little brown Dachshund dog with his little red collar and his red and white Santa hat on outside an Aldi store. And next to him is a silver salver with the lid taken off and the dog mince pies sitting on the tray. And the dog has got a huge tongue coming out licking his lips. In fact, it's so big it's covering his nose.
Hiya, it's Gavin. And I've got some readings for you from the 5th of December. Baggies must keep a close eye on QPR hotshot Burrell. There is no doubt who Ryan Mason's album must keep tabs on in West London tomorrow. QPR hotshot Roman Burrell is carving himself a fine reputation in a debut senior championship campaign, having arrived from Burton Albion in the summer. Birmingham-born Burrell has fired in 5 goals in the last 7 games and netted 7 for the season for Julian Stevens' mid-table side. It is not a record dissimilar to Albion hitman Orna Hegabo, who has 5 goals at a better rate of his last 4 games and 7 in total for the campaign. Burrell continued his good scoring form at Norwich's Carrow Road last time out. He struck to make it 1-1 in Norfolk, but the host went on to record a first home league win of the campaign. It was a disappointing end to what ours boss Stephen labelled a good week. QPR had previously seen off Hull 3-2 at Loftus Road in their previous home game, as Burrell converted the winner and won 1-0 at Blackburn in midweek, courtesy of Paul Smith's late effort. Burrell's flurry of goals have arrived since mid-October and come in decisive moments for narrow wins for his side. QPR's hit their straps at the end of August for an unbeaten September and look to have responded from a wobble in early November. The 24-year-old, who won his first of 5 Jamaica caps in May, had a breakthrough move to Middlesbrough after playing for Grimsby, but it took a couple of prolific seasons in the third tier of Scottish football to find his feet in the English Football League. With 2 games being away, it's a good week. Not a perfect week, but it's a good week. Former Baggy and ours regular Sam Field has made 8 starts and 3 appearances as substitute this term. Obviously, it's Monday now, and Saturday Baggies lost to QPR 3-1. Good news for travellers as rail strike called off. Rail travellers have been given some good news after a planned industrial action by a rail union was suspended. Cross-country customers are being advised that a normal service will now operate tomorrow and subsequent Saturdays in December, following the suspension of planned industrial action by the RMT union. Cross-country said Saturday was expected to be a busy day for many town and city centres across the network, with planned engineering work and Christmas events meaning busier trains than usual. In particular, this Saturday we'll see cross-country services between Derby and the North East in Scotland extended by up to an hour due to engineering work in the Chesterfield area. The rail provider calls at Birmingham New Street, Wolverhampton and Stafford within the West Midlands, and cross-country's managing director, Shayana Rolfe, said it was good to be able to run a normal timetable. She said, We are pleased that the RMT has called off planned strike action throughout December, and we look forward to welcoming passengers on board. We aim to run our normal timetable on Saturday, but the short time available to reinstate services means there may be some short notice cancellations. A brief history. Wooden huts with fairy lights and stalls selling glühwein might feel like a fairly recent phenomenon, but they've been part of the country's festive landscape for ages, and elsewhere for even longer. Writing in The Conversation, Aurelie Brockerhoff, research fellow at Coventry University, and Christina Galilei, lecturer in marketing, University of Leicester, said the first Christmas markets were found in medieval Germany, where they marked the pre-Christmas season. Peasants and farmers alike could buy boots, housewares and equipment, while high society could pick up handcrafted jewellery, toys, wigs or wood-turned items. Throughout the 20th century, consecutive governments attempted to reinvigorate Christmas markets. Nazi Germany, and later the German Democratic Republic, used them to serve their political, social and cultural purposes. The first German format Christmas markets in the UK were started in Lincoln in 1982 and in Birmingham in 1997. They reflected a wider trend. Many European cities saw the success of Christmas markets in Germany and began hosting their own. Now, Christmas markets make a significant contribution to the UK's winter economy. They attract visitors from out of town, create temporary jobs and increase sales for local shops and cafes. Over the last 35 years, they have grown in number, size, duration and footfall. Estimated visitor spend at Christmas markets doubled between 2015 and 2017, reaching 500 million. Markets in the UK have become travel destinations. I apologise for my pronunciation of the word glühwein at the beginning of that. Two men charged with drug offences. Two men have been charged with drug offences in Sandwell. Police stopped a car in Albury and Class A drugs and cash were found. Adam Liquat, 19, of West Bromwich, was charged with possession of a firearm with intent to endanger life, wounding, possession of Class A drugs with intent to supply, and driving offences. Yakuba Sawenya, 19, from Erdington, was charged with possession of Class A drugs with intent to supply.
Hello everyone, this is Linda, reading from Saturday, the 6th of December's Express and Star. Trip back in time to a world of exciting and happy times. Some thoughts by Dan Morris. It was the smell of the well-worn wooden floor of the hall, coupled with the sublime scent of a festive turkey dinner, emanating from the kitchen. One breath in, one breath out, and I was home. No, dear readers, I did not find myself last Friday beside the warm hearth of some country estate, nor was I nestled in the comfort of some traditional Edwardian watering hole, musing over the delight of the season to come. The reason this time for my Cheshire cat grin of nostalgic contentment was in fact that I was visiting one of our region's many fantastic primary schools. Though Sproglet is only three, as other parents will know, the time has come to prospect the locale for the next phase of her education. This being the case, her mother and I arranged a day last week to take a tour of some of our area's shining lights in shaping the little uns, and it was both incredibly enjoyable and exuberantly enlightening. Little Missy's mum is a teacher herself, and therefore was coming into said tour far more armed between the ears than your average bear. For yours truly, my last experience of a primary school was 26 years ago, when, after a truly sublime time, and in fact my very first job on a newspaper, I left one. As such, despite a bit of online research, I was coming in comparatively blind. This did, however, give me the untainted opportunity to experience the absolute joy in how things have changed over the course of the last quarter of a century. Let me be crystal clear, my primary school experience was excellent and my teachers were all first class. But these were different times in many ways, and happily, at least it appears to me, times are now better for a lot of schools' young charges. With the biggest case in point, I was delighted to see how much care, commitment and strategy is now involved in helping those pupils who may need extra or at least different support. Sadly, I recall a case during my own time at primary school where one of my peers was on the verge of being held back a year because of his apparent lack of progress. This demoralising measure was all set to be given the green light until it was established that he was in fact dyslexic. At the time, said school apparently had no real experience in dealing with such a commonplace condition, and so parties involved were prepared to implement a solution that would doubtlessly have been devastating to his self-esteem. As I say, times are now quite clearly better. The SEND provision at every school I visited last week appeared to be exceptionally well thought out, with everything possible tailored to the individual students in need of its services. Said chap from my era certainly had the last laugh. He wasn't held back in the end, and has in fact gone on to become a God-chiselled bodybuilding behemoth, winning trophies for his efforts left, right and centre. Still, back then, the system came very close to failing him, and it is excellent to see that now, similar instances of crucial matters being overlooked seem a lot less likely. On top of this, I was, very naively, blown away by the extent to which technology is now employed as a primary school resource. Monitors and screens in every classroom that put my own ridiculous home telly set up to shame, coupled with iPad trolleys and state-of-the-art IT suits firmly put paid to my memories of one dot matrix printer for 200 kids. Forest school setups and outdoor play equipment were also a joy to behold, particularly as an encouraging balance to the embracement of the digital world. In general, I was incredibly impressed and excited about the world that awaited my progeny. But in a particularly heartwarming moment in the aforementioned school hall, I was also transported back to my own days in early years education. Christmas dinner was about to be served. The joy of the burgeoning season was in the air, and I was instantly engulfed by a perfect combination of pride and jealousy over the magical years that my daughter very shortly has in store for her. A few days later, I bumped into one of my own outstanding primary school teachers at our local church. Introducing my daughter properly to her for the first time, she looked her up and down, smiled, and winked. It's what Elton John would have called the circle of life, and it does indeed move us all. Bring on the nativities. More on that next week. Peaky Blinders has eye on film locations in city. A location spotter working on a forthcoming Peaky Blinders drama has been seen looking for sites in Wolverhampton. Last month, the BBC announced that the hit crime drama set in inner city Birmingham between the two world wars will be making a comeback 3 years after the final series had been broadcast. Creator Stephen Knight said two further series would be set in post-war Birmingham, with a new generation of the Shelby family exploiting opportunities of a new city emerging from the conflict. Previous series had been filmed extensively at the Black Country's Living Museum in Dudley, and the forthcoming Peaky Blinders movie includes scenes filmed by the canal at Bumblehole Nature Reserve in the Netherton area of Dudley. But this time, a spotter for the new series has been seen eyeing up the area around St John's Church, off Snow Hill in Wolverhampton. It is understood that the spotter, a young woman, was looking for a location which featured a church in an old-fashioned looking street. The approach to St John's Church from George Street, a Georgian tree-lined avenue, was deemed as being ideal for a filming location. It also has the advantage of a secluded backwater location, which would allow for filming in relative privacy, without the need for a major traffic disruption. Knight, who last year opened a new studio in the Digbeth area of Birmingham, said the Peaky Blinders story would pick up in 1953, where the battle to win the contract for Birmingham's massive reconstruction project becomes a brutal contest of mythical dimensions. "I'm thrilled to be announcing this new chapter in the Peaky Blinders story," he said. "Once again, it will be rooted in Birmingham and will tell the story of a city rising from the ashes of the Birmingham Blitz. The new generation of Shelbys have taken the wheel, and it will be a hell of a ride." Lindsay Salt, director of BBC Drama, added, "This game-changing show made a huge impact when it first came to our screens 12 years ago, and this is one of the BBC's most loved dramas. Stephen has worked his magic once again, and I can't wait for his scripts to be brought to life when filming begins in Birmingham. We are delighted to be working with Kudos, Garrison Drama and Netflix on this epic show. There's plenty of drama for Peaky fans to look forward to." Richard Parker, elected mayor for the West Midlands, said Peaky Blinders was a worldwide phenomenon that had boosted the region's tourism and global research. "We're proud to be working with the team bringing the production back to the Shelby's home of Birmingham, and job opportunities will follow for local people to become part of this story," he added. "It's this sort of backing from some of the biggest names that will turn the West Midlands into the creative capital of the UK." Childs in skin cancer diagnosis. Columnist and West Brom fan Adrian Childs has revealed he has undergone an operation to remove a cancerous patch of skin from his shoulder. The 58-year-old TV presenter from Hagley near Stourbridge was given the diagnosis after he spotted a suspicious skin patch, which a biopsy later confirmed to be cancerous. In his column for The Guardian, Radio 5 Live presenter Childs said that he got his shoulder checked by a dermatologist who told him to have it removed. He said it was confirmed to be a squamous cell carcinoma, a type of skin cancer caused by an overproduction of squamous cells in the top layer of the skin. "All removed and won't spread," the former host of The One Show said, adding, "so nothing but not serious. Needs keeping an eye on." Inferno destroys fireworks depot. A fire at a fireworks storage unit was compared to a war zone by locals who were on the scene during the blaze. The warehouse on Plecker Road, Walsall, created explosions and sent flames high into the air. A total of 11 fire engines, 2 brigade response vehicles and a hydraulic aerial ladder platform from West Midlands Fire Service were used to bring the blaze under control. Fireworks stored in the warehouse exploded, making it more difficult to tackle. Roads in the area were sealed off after the fire took hold on Thursday night and did not reopen until yesterday as damping down continued. The fire happened close to Walsall Manor Hospital. Some staff and patients watched from windows as it took hold. Jason Tift, aged 49, from Karma, said, "At first it seemed like absolute chaos, and you had pedestrians walking through near to where material was exploding off the roof. The firefighters did their best to control the scene. When an explosion happened, they moved the public out of the way. I was about 10 metres away from the explosion. It was quite dramatic, to be honest with you. It was like being in a war zone. It's right across the road from the hospital as well, and I did actually see patients up out of their beds peering through the windows." Killer sentencing is held up after failure to discover true age. The sentencing of Bescot railway station murderer Deng Chol Majek has been delayed until next year after medical and legal professionals failed to determine how old he is. Following his arrest shortly, he murdered hotel worker Rhiannon White on October the 20th last year. Majek spent months pretending to not be mentally fit to stand trial. Now a convicted murderer, there continues to be a dispute over the age of the Sudanese asylum seeker. Miss White's family hoped to see justice finally done during Majek's sentencing on Monday, December the 15th, but now they will have to wait 6 more weeks until the new year. Hoping for a more lenient sentence, Majek maintains he is 19. Despite paperwork processed by Italian authorities on arrival from Sudan, stating he was born in 1998. 3 weeks ago, Justice Michael Saul, KC, ordered the murderer to undergo a CT scan of his clavicle so experts could assess his age. On Thursday, Justice Saul told a hearing at Wolverhampton Crown Court time had run out to get a definite answer in time, and Majek would now learn his fate on January the 30th. He said, "We have the position whereby if there is no radiologist available, the neurologist cannot produce any sort of report. We have used court funds to produce 3 reports which has proved nothing in terms of any substance with the purpose of age assessment, and we have a hearing on December the 15th. Majek, who was staying at the Park Inn Hotel, followed Miss White to Bescot Railway Station with a screwdriver and plunged it into her over 20 times. The 27-year-old, who was working at the hotel, died from her wounds in hospital days later. During his trial, the jury was shown video of Majek staring at his victim while she tended bar, and then, minutes after killing her, drinking and smoking with friends. Prosecutor Michelle Healy, KC, said, "I'm afraid we have determined it could be done, finding out Majek's age through a CT scan, but as the CT scan is not for a medical purpose, the timing has defeated us. With only a finite number of radiologists, neurologists, CT scanning machines and slots available, medical professionals are loath to use them for Majek over those whose health will be improved by their use." Majek's defence lawyer, Gurdeep Garcha, KC, wanted his client's age determined by social workers interviewing him, which will again require the services of a Sudanese interpreter, despite hotel workers insisting he understood English. He said, "I was pessimistic that could be done in the very tight schedule that we have. With the best will in the world, with the different issues in play, the best course of action would be to vacate the date of this month and instead push ahead for a date we could agree upon in January." Justice Sewell expressed concern that if the sentencing hearing went ahead on December the 15th, Miss White's family could have attended and been met with another delay on the day.
Hello, this is Janet reading from the Express and Star for Monday the 8th of December. Mason frustrated as passive Albion lose on the road again. Boss Ryan Mason pointed to a passive first half display and costly individual errors as Albion tumbled to more away day misery. A 3-1 defeat at Queen's Park Rangers is a sixth consecutive away defeat for the Baggies, who were booed off once again by the travelling faithful in West London. Mason was exasperated by a first-half display he labelled as passive, a far cry from the rousing second-half comeback win at home to Swansea the previous weekend. His side once again failed to build on a victory as they slumped to 16th. The hosts took the lead on the stroke of half-time, and Roman Burrell accepted two second-half gifts for the R's to seal the win despite owner Hegbo's fine header. "We were far too passive in the first half, far too passive, and obviously in the second half we gifted them two goals, and it's not something that you can do at this level or at any level," Mason said. "The formula away from home is certainly something that we're chasing to try and help the lads, because at the minute it's not working." He added, "My opinion in the first half was it was just too passive and the energy, the intensity wasn't there. There wasn't many chances, but more than that, it was the performance that we didn't show ourselves. In the second half, we did. It changed. It was different. There was a different energy, you know. It was a lot more brave, a lot more aggressive. We were a better team in the second half, barring two costly individual errors, which is tough to take. Fans once again travelled well with the 1,700 allocation sold out, though there were empty seats in the Loftus Road away section. But Baggies fans were once again treated to a gloomy away day and more capital punishment, as four of the six straight defeats have arrived in or around London clubs. The terrible runaway from the Hawthorns came after a bright start for the Baggies on their travels this term, but a Josh Griffiths-inspired win at Norwich on October the 1st feels a distant memory. Griffiths was dropped for Joe Wildsmith at Loftus Road after recent errors, but the number two was unable to keep QPR at bay. He was partly at fault for the third goal and was let off another error by Burrell's open goal miss. Asked about the following and their audible boos, the head coach replied, Of course, 100%, our fans are incredible in terms of how much they travel. They bring the numbers. I think there was a sellout from the away end, which is amazing. We managed to win 3 away games relatively early this season, and we thought we kind of changed that feeling of being away from home and not being able to pick up results. But that hasn't been the case for a good number of weeks now. I understand the frustrations. I'm frustrated too. The players are frustrated. We need to give back to the fans, and at the moment we're not being able to give back to them away from home. So I fully understand the frustrations, the disappointment. Better buses and services after a boost. Millions of passengers in the West Midlands are set to benefit from faster, cheaper and more reliable buses, the government said after announcing a £264.1 million boost for services and infrastructure. The landmark funding follows the Bus Services Act becoming law in October, giving local authorities the power to run local services how they see fit and provide greater protection to socially necessary routes. Transport Secretary Heidi Alexander said, "After years of decline, better buses are finally on the way. Our £3 billion investment will give local authorities the long-term funding they need to deliver lower fares, more frequent services and the reliable transport that communities depend on. The allocations bring together various bus funding streams into one source. Millions in funding will be allocated to local authorities in the West Midlands every single year up to 2028 to 29 and can be spent however they want." Richard Parker, Mayor of the West Midlands, said, "Thousands of people rely on our bus network every day to get to where they need to be, and I'm taking back control of our buses to ensure our network remains affordable and accessible. Online system is unfair to many. As a pensioner in receipt of the state pension, I also claim housing benefit and council tax support. Periodically, I need to provide the council with evidence of my income in order for me to continue claiming these benefits. This year, the letter from the City of Wolverhampton Council told me that the review statement had to be completed online. Not being online at home, I booked a library computer and went along with my paperwork to complete the online statement, only to find that the web page did not work. I subsequently sent emails and submitted an online feedback form with no response. I also tried to submit an online complaint, only to find that this too did not work. When the local councillor held her surgery at the library, I sat her down at the computer and demonstrated that the website was not working. The review eventually had to be completed over the phone, and even then the phone signal kept dropping out. I am vehemently opposed to the move towards online-only services, and my experience shows what happens when the online services fail. We normally pride ourselves on drafting and passing legislation to ensure that minority groups are not discriminated against. So I have a question. Why is it not unlawful in this country to discriminate against the digitally excluded? For example, energy companies often only make their cheapest tariffs available to those customers who have an online account and in some cases have also agreed to have a smart meter. Do you think that this is something that needs to be challenged? Police plea after £2,000 is stolen. Police have released photo of a man they hope to identify after £2,000 was stolen from an elderly man in West Bromwich. West Midlands police officers are investigating reports that a man approached the victim in his 80s on the high street between 11:30 a.m. and 11:50 a.m. on October the 29th. The victim noticed food had been sprayed onto his jacket with a man attempting to help clean it. During the interaction, an envelope containing cash was accidentally dropped. The suspect is then reported to have stolen the money, around £2,000, and fled the scene. A spokesperson for West Midlands Police said, "We would like to talk to the person in the images as we believe he could have vital information to help with our investigation. The photo can be seen on our website at expressandstar.com. Hello, this is Janet reading from the Express and Star for Monday the 8th of December. Mason frustrated as passive Albion lose on the road again. Boss Ryan Mason pointed to a passive first half display and costly individual errors as Albion tumbled to more away day misery. A 3-1 defeat at Queen's Park Rangers is a sixth consecutive away defeat for the Baggies, who were booed off once again by the travelling faithful in West London. Mason was exasperated by a first half display he labelled as passive, a far cry from the rousing second half comeback win at home to Swansea the previous weekend. His side once again failed to build on a victory as they slumped to 16th. The hosts took the lead on the stroke of half time, and Ruman Burrell accepted two second half gifts for the R's to seal the win despite owner Hegabo's fine header. We were far too passive in the first half, far too passive, and obviously in the second half we gifted them two goals, and it's not something that you can do at this level, or at any level, Mason said. The formula away from home is certainly something that we're chasing to try and help the lads, because at the minute it's not working. He added, "My opinion in the first half was it was just too passive, and the energy, the intensity, wasn't there. There wasn't many chances, but more than that, it was the performance that we didn't show ourselves. In the second half, we did. It changed. It was different. There was a different energy, you know. It was a lot more brave, a lot more aggressive. We were a better team in the second half, barring two costly individual errors, which is tough to take. Fans once again travelled well with the 1,700 allocation sold out, though there were empty seats in the Loftus Road away section. But Baggies fans were once again treated to a gloomy away day and more capital punishment as four of the six straight defeats have arrived in or around London clubs. The terrible runaway from the Hawthorns came after a bright start for the Baggies on their travels this term. But a Josh Griffiths-inspired win at Norwich on October the 1st feels a distant memory. Griffiths was dropped for Joe Wildsmith at Loftus Road after recent errors, but the number two was unable to keep QPR at bay. He was partly at fault for the third goal and was let off another error by Burrell's open goal miss. Asked about the following and their audible boos, the head coach replied, "Of course, 100%. Our fans are incredible in terms of how much they travel. They bring the numbers. I think there was a sellout from the away end, which is amazing. We managed to win three away games relatively early this season, and we thought we kind of changed that feeling of being away from home and not being able to pick up results. But that hasn't been the case for a good number of weeks now. I understand the frustrations. I'm frustrated too. The players are frustrated. We need to give back to the fans, and at the moment we're not being able to give back to them away from home. So I fully understand the frustrations, the disappointment." Bar may lose licence over violent incident involving door staff. A pub could lose its licence over an assault involving door staff and an offensive weapon. Rajinder Singh, the owner of the Prince of Wales in West Bromwich High Street, will face Sandal Council's licensing committee after an assault involving the pub's bouncers last month. West Midlands Police said it had received a call from a member of the public because three people were bleeding from the head after an incident at the Prince of Wales at around 12:30 a.m. on November the 16th. The force said the incident started inside the High Street pub, which opens until 11 p.m. or 12:30 a.m. at weekends, and spilled out onto the street. Officers reported wounding with intent, one offence of grievous bodily harm and another assault causing actually bodily harm, and were investigating the possession of an offensive weapon. The force said it was concerned the incident involved the pub's staff and bouncers. Sandal Council's licensing committee temporarily suspended the pub's licence on November the 19th, ahead of a full hearing. The committee, which has the power to change or revoke the licence, will meet on Thursday to decide whether to make the suspension permanent. The minutes from the private hearing on November 19th said the incident involved the pub's door staff who had physically assaulted customers and used a weapon. Security had thrown punches and used excessive force, the report continued. West Midlands Police said the offensive weapon used during the incident had been kept behind the bar and handed to the pub's bouncers by bar staff who were aware that a weapon was stored there. West Midlands Police said licence holder Rajinder Singh had done nothing during the incident and watched on. He said he knew nothing about the security or bar staff offering them cash in hand and was unaware of their immigration status, according to the licensing report. West Midlands Police said it was clear from CCTV footage that the incident had escalated unnecessarily.
Welcome back to the Express and Star News Quiz. And this week's round, it's the Good and Interesting News Round. Question 1. Which two stadiums in Birmingham have been confirmed as part of a UK bid to host FIFA Women's World Cup 2035? Question 2. What was named the nation's favourite Christmas film, according to a poll conducted by the British Board of Film Classification, the BBFC? Question 3. Which 1970s glam rock band from the Black Country is embarking on a farewell tour, including a show at Birmingham's O2 Academy this month? Question 4. What brought motorway traffic to a standstill on the M1 near Northampton in the East Midlands? Question 5. What was Oxford University Press Word of the Year? Question 6. What has been named the UK's most streamed Christmas song from the 21st century? Question 7. Which European president will the King and Queen Camilla host for a state visit this week? Question 8. Armed police, Royal Marines and the Coast Guard hunted down what animal after it fled a festive celebration in a seaside town? Question 9. Playwright Sir Tom Stoppard has died aged 88, but which screenplay did he win an Oscar for? And question 10. Old curtains from which royal residence have been recycled into festive stockings for a charity auction? Here are the answers for the Good and Interesting News Round. Question 1. Which two stadiums in Birmingham have been confirmed as part of a UK bid to host FIFA Women's World Cup 2035. Villa Park and the Powerhouse, the new 62,000 capacity stadium planned by Birmingham City FC. Question 2. What was named the nation's favourite Christmas film according to a poll conducted by the British Board of Film Classification, the BBFC? Home Alone. Question 3. Which 1970s glam rock band from the Black Country is embarking on a farewell tour, including a show at Birmingham's O2 Academy this month? Slade. Question 4. What brought motorway traffic to a standstill on the M1 near Northampton in the East Midlands? A confused swan. Question 5. What was Oxford University Press Word of the Year? Rage bait. Online content deliberately designed to elicit anger or outrage. Question 6. What has been named the UK's most streamed Christmas song from the 21st century? Leona Lewis's One More Sleep. Question 8. Armed police, Royal Marines and the Coast Guard hunted down what animal after it fled a festive celebration in a seaside town? A reindeer. Question 9. Playwright Sir Tom Stoppard has died aged 88, but which screenplay did he win an Oscar for? Shakespeare in Love. And question 10. Old curtains from which royal residence have been recycled into festive stockings for a charity auction? Sandringham. Thanks for joining me in this week's quiz. I'm Sarah Ann, and I'll be back next time. Bye!
Some audio described TV programmes for the next week, along with radio programme highlights from Talking News Federation. Search for publications TNF Soundings to hear these directly on their website.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, this is Glenys from Wharfdale Talking News, with a selection of audio described TV programmes from the main channels. The week starts on Saturday, the 13th of December. Until Friday, the 19th of December, I'm also reading this week's selection. So, starting with Saturday, the 13th of December, on BBC One at 11:30, we have Mary Berry, Love to Cook. Even though she's the queen of the kitchen, Mary Berry spends just as much time in the garden, growing the ingredients for her delicious dishes. At 1 p.m, Paddy McGuinness goes inside the Christmas factory with a visit to a chocolate factory in Belgium. This is followed at 2 by the film Stickman, an animated film telling the tale of a happy-go-lucky father's epic journey to make it home in time for Christmas. We have another film at 2:45 p.m. Night at the Museum, action comedy. Looking for a regular job, Larry instead gets the most irregular role of night guard at a New York museum, where the exhibits come to life after sunset. At 6:35, it's the semi-final of Strictly Come Dancing, and the remaining couples must dance twice to win a place in the grand final. At 9:05, there's the final part of Wild Cherry, when the net closes in on the girls as Juliet and Lorna find out the truth. And the evening rounds off at 11:35 p.m. with Tommy, the good, the bad, the fury. Molly comes to support Tommy at a triathlon, but there's a backlash. And on BBC Two, children's programmes start at 6:45 a.m. with Big Lizard, followed at 7:10 by Stage Stars. At 11:30 a.m, there's Alison Hammond's Florida Unpacked. Alison and Aidan are in the Florida Keys, soaring high and looking for sea turtles. This is followed at 12 by Nigella, Cook, Eat, Repeat, Christmas Special. Nigella has food from near and far, including Linzer cookies and pomegranate cocktails. This is followed at 1 p.m. by Gorilla Family and Me. Gordon Buchanan meets a family of rare Grauer's gorillas facing a new threat from poachers. The evening on BBC Two ends at 10:15 p.m. with Wham! Last Christmas Unwrapped. Tells the story of how George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley's Wham! Turned one song into a cultural phenomenon. And on ITV, at 7 a.m. we have Love Your Garden, with Alan and his team heading to Waltham Abbey to create a tropical escape with yoga deck and home office for a leukemia survivor. Now to 4 p.m. for The Love of Dogs with Alison Hammond at Christmas. Alison returns to Battersea Dogs Home for a festive special. From 4:50, there's Capital's Jingle Bell Ball 25. Highlights from the UK's biggest Christmas party at the O2 in London. The evening rounds off at 10:25 p.m. with the film The Batman, epic crime drama film reboot where sadistic serial killer causes a superhero to investigate the corruption of his home city. And onto Channel 4. The morning starts at 8:10 with two episodes of Everybody Loves Raymond, followed at 9:10 by two episodes of Frasier. And from 10:10, there are three episodes of The Simpsons. For football fans, at 11:45 a.m, there's the Wolves versus Nottingham Forest Women's FA Cup match. Two cookery programmes follow from 4:15 p.m, with Jamie's Cook Ahead Christmas, when Jamie shows us how to prep in advance so no one misses any festive fun. And from 5:15, there's the Great Christmas Bake Off from 2023. At 7 p.m, we have two programmes from Sandy Toksvig. Extraordinary Escapes at Christmas see Sandy and friends exploring awe-inspiring locations in snowy Norway. And at 8:05, on the Great Riviera Rail Trip, Sandy visits the poshest hotel imaginable in Nice and hangs out in the opulent Cape of Billionaires. This is followed at 9:05 by Miriam's Dickensian Christmas. Self-confessed Christmas Scrooge Miriam Margolyes seeks inspiration in her love of Charles Dickens and in the festive traditions in A Christmas Carol. At 10:05, there's the sci-fi action adventure film 65, when a spaceman crash lands on a strange planet where giant lizards stalk the darkness. 65 million years ago. Where on earth is he? This is followed at 11:50 by the film Boxing Day, a Yuletide rom-com when a successful author returns to London so that his American fiancé can meet the family. But he's not mentioned that his ex is a world-famous singer. On Sunday the 14th of December, on BBC One, from 10:30 a.m, we have My Life at Christmas. Renita Irani meets Aidy Edipitan to explore his journey to Paralympic glory. At 1:50 p.m, there's Lifeline. Gary Roslin presents an appeal on behalf of Harry's Hat, a charity dedicated to improving the lives of children with hydrocephalus. At 2 p.m, there's Kingdom. As the lions move against their rivals, can anyone match the force of this powerful pride? This is followed at 2:55 p.m. by the film Night at the Museum, Battle of the Smithsonian, action comedy sequel. The museum exhibits are sent to storage in Washington, and they call Larry for help fighting a supernatural threat. At 5:05, there's the final episode of Kingdom, highlighting the conservationists, anti-poaching teams and the film crews who made the series. At 7:45 p.m, there's Strictly Come Dancing, The Results. Kylie Minogue and Five perform in the studio ahead of this year's last dance-off. From 8:30pm, there are two episodes of the new drama, The War Between the Land and the Sea, when Barclay makes a terrifying descent into the world of Homo Aqua. And on BBC Two, at 11:30, there's Nigelissima, when Nigella creates this Christmas buffet menu inspired by a trip to Venice. There's another cookery programme at 1:15pm, when the great food guys, Nick and Dougie, and guests roast a loin of roe deer with potato rosti. At 1:45pm, Alison Hammond's Florida Unpacked sees Alison and Aidan having a fishing crash course, then driving over the famous 7 Mile Bridge in the Florida Keys. At 5:40pm, there's the final episode of Celebrity Race Across the World, with the teams racing from Medellin in Colombia to the northernmost point of South America. Which of them will triumph? This is followed at 6:40 by Top Gear. A motorcyclist and a pair of park hour runners help pay tribute to BBC Television Centre. At 7:45pm, there's The World's Most Dangerous Roads, with Darren and Ria in South Africa, with over 1 million square kilometres of wilderness waiting to be explored. This is followed from 8:30pm by two films. The first is The Holiday, a comedy where two women from different countries swap homes to get away from their relationship issues. And at 10:35pm, there's Crazy Rich Asians. New Yorker Rachel discovers her boyfriend is from one of Singapore's wealthiest families. And to ITV1, at 6:30am, there's James Martin's Spanish Adventure from Madrid, with James trying a calamari sandwich, garlic prawns and churros. He also meets a blind fruit food critic, has some vermouth and cooks roast pork with caviar lentils. At 11:30am, there's the documentary series Fletcher's Family Farm. A week of important decisions sees a new calf named, plans taking shape for the family's return to life on the farm, and an assessment of the oat crop. From 2:15pm, there's the film The Grinch, an animated adventure comedy film with a cynical grump annoyed with the ever-present Christmas cheer of his neighbours. At 6pm, there's The Great Escapers, Loose Women in Costa Brava. Denise Welsh, Katie Piper and Sunetra Sarkar head to the Costa Brava and compete to throw the best holiday there. This is followed at 7pm by Celebrity Catchphrase Christmas Special, a festive edition where guests try to say what they see for a chance to win £50,000. At 8pm we have the 1% Club, a quiz where it doesn't matter how good you are at quizzes, and where 100 contestants could win up to £100,000. This is followed at 9pm by Accidental Tourist. Stephen Mulhern is sent to South Korea to face his fears by experiencing raw seafood, extreme acupuncture and a nerve-wracking freedive. And to round off the evening's viewing at 10:15pm, there's Super Pumped, The Battle for Uber, Grow or Die. The first episode of a US drama based on real events. Uber cab CEO Travis Kalanick sets his sights on a venture capitalist as a partner for his fledgling firm. And so to Channel 4. From 8am, there's two episodes of Everybody Loves Raymond, followed at 9am by two episodes of Frasier, and at 1pm by two episodes of The Simpsons. At 3:10, we have Kirsty and Phil's Love It or List It, with a family of five bursting out of their three-bedroom semi. Will they stay or renovate to achieve the potential of their existing home? At 4:45pm, there's the film Miracle on 34th Street, festive family drama, with Richard Attenborough starring as a departmental store Santa, who insists he's the real Santa Claus. At 7pm, we have Hotel Chocolat at Christmas, an exclusive festive glimpse behind the scenes in Hotel Chocolat's inventing room and its attempt to design, make and sell 50 million chocolates. Followed at 8 p.m. by Game of Wool, Britain's best knitter. The remaining knitters refashion Aran jumpers into striking catwalk dresses and repurpose fabric to craft unique bags. At 9 p.m, there's 24 hours in police custody, breakout, as dozens of detainees escape from Yarl's Wood Immigration Removal Centre. Cameras go deep inside the high-octane manhunt. But was the breakout random or planned by outsiders? This is followed at 10 p.m. by social media monsters. When Leah Ware stopped posting on Facebook, her family assumed she still lived on a farm with the boyfriend she'd met online. But then another woman vanishes and suspicions mount. At 11 p.m, there's the next episode of Say Nothing, Theatre People, a gripping story of murder and memory during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And at 5 to 12, there's a film, XXX, The Next Level. This is an action thriller. There's a new triple X agent in town, and he's up against some shady government business. And now for those programmes which are on at the same time each day. On BBC One at 10:45 a.m, there's Animal Park. At 11:30, Homes Under the Hammer. At 12:15, Bargain Hunt. At 4:30, Pointless Celebrities. At 7:30, EastEnders. On ITV, at 2 p.m, there's Dickinson's Real Deal. And at 7:30, EastEnders. Please note that on Wednesday, this is on at 7 o'clock. At 8, there's Coronation Street, but not on Thursday or Friday. On Channel 4, at 6:35 a.m, there's The King of Queens. At 7, Everybody Loves Raymond. At 9:10, Frasier. At 11:10, American Pickers. At 1:10, Jamie Does Christmas, a variety of programmes in the lead-up to Christmas. At 4, there's Kirsty's Handmade Christmas. At 5, there's Chateau DIY. And at 9, there's First Dates Beach Club, where hopeful singles look for romance in Spain. And so on to the rest of the schedule. On Monday, the 15th of December, at 2 p.m, Nigella's Amsterdam Christmas. Nigella travels to Amsterdam to enjoy the festive season. At 8:30 p.m, Ghosts Christmas Special. A festive trip down memory lane prompts Pat to question his very identity. And the ghosts come up with a surprise Christmas present for Alison, whose family lunch does not go to plan. At 9 p.m, Celebrity MasterChef, and it's finals week. Things take a sweet turn as pastry skills and spectacular creations come to the fore. At 11:15 p.m, there's the Christmas film Bump. The Chalmers Davis family head to Colombia for a Christmas cruise to see Rosa's homeland. On BBC Two, at 9 p.m, Civilizations, Rise and Fall. For 250 years, Japan has thrived, mostly cut off from the West, until US gunboats arrive. At 10 p.m, Mammoth. Head teacher Mr. Cowley is signed off with stress, and Mammoth wants him back. At 11 p.m, there's the film Hell or High Water. A divorced father and his ex-con older brother resort to a desperate scheme. ITV One. At 11:40 p.m, Heathrow, Britain's busiest airport. Britain is on the cusp of holiday season, and Heathrow is revving up for global passengers. Channel 4. At 8 p.m, there's Jamie's Cook Ahead Christmas, when Jamie shows us how to have a stress-free Christmas Eve, from a genius new way to cook the turkey to an epic Yorkshire pudding and the best roasties ever. At 10 p.m, there's Social Media Monsters. Carson Sistrunk disappeared after going to see a woman he first met on Snapchat. The police investigation uncovered a disturbing pattern of deception and crime. And at 11:05, we have Say Nothing, the 8th episode in this gripping story of murder and memory during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Tuesday, 16th of December. On BBC One at 2 p.m, there's Shakespeare and Hathaway, Private Investigators, with a Christmas special, when Sebastian's first solo case doesn't go as planned. At 8 p.m, there's Celebrity MasterChef. Contestants battle for one of the three places in the finals, cooking dishes for someone special in their lives. At 9, there's the final episode of What's the Monarchy For?, when David Dimbleby examines how the royals have shaped their public image. And at 10:40 p.m, there's the film Bridget Jones' Diary, a romantic comedy about a weight-obsessed 30-something searching for love. On BBC Two, at 7 p.m, there's A Taste of Christmas with Andy Oliver, where Andy joins three families from different cultural backgrounds to share their different food traditions. At 8, Mortimer and Whitehouse go Hogmanay fishing on the rivers Dee and Tay. At 9:45, there's The World's Most Dangerous Roads from Morocco. And at 11 p.m, there's the third episode of Brawn, the impossible Formula One story. On ITV, at 9, we go inside M&S at Christmas, exploring every corner of this high street giant at their busiest time of the year. At 10:45, there's the film Batman. Bruce Wayne, the Caped Crusader, investigates when Gotham City political elite are picked off by a serial killer. And to Channel 4, at 8, there's A Very British Christmas from Bamborough Castle, showing their preparations for the festive season. At 10, there's Gogglebox for SU2C, with well-known faces talking about television. And at 11:05, there's the final episode of Say Nothing, the gripping drama set in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. On Wednesday the 17th of December at 2 p.m, there's Father Brown investigating when a body is found of a woman who went missing 7 years earlier. At 2:45 p.m, there's Escape to the Country, with a first-time buyer from Birmingham looking to relocate to rural Shropshire. At 8 p.m, there's the Repair Shop Christmas Special, with experts repairing two giant puffins, a magic lantern projector, and a donkey saddle. At 9, there's A Merry Berry Christmas, when Mary shares the joy and warmth and wonder of the festive period with guests and friends. At 10:40, there's the film Bridget Jones, The Edge of Reason. Now in a relationship with Mark Darcy, Bridget finds herself drawn once again to the dastardly Daniel Cleaver. On BBC Two at 2:15 p.m, there's Life in the Snow, when Gordon Buchanan explores how animals such as the brown bear and polar bear survive in the winter wonderland. At 7, there's Simply Nigella Christmas Special, when Nigella presents her guide to stress-free festive cooking. At 8, Mortimer and Whitehouse go Christmas fishing from the River Lot in southern France, where they hope to catch black bass, grass carp, and Vandoise. At 9, we have The Hairy Bikers, You'll Never Ride Alone, a documentary celebrating the life of hairy biker Dave Myers. ITV Tonight at 7:30 has League Cup football with Newcastle versus Fulham. And while this isn't audio described, you may want to tune in and follow the commentary. On Channel 4 at 8, we go inside Legoland at Christmas. The festive countdown is underway in the Legoland theme park in Windsor. At 11:05, there's Travelman, 24 Hours in Rio, when Joe Lycett and Stephen Mangan spend a whistle stop 4 days in Rio de Janeiro. Now to Thursday, 18th of December. On BBC One at 2 p.m, there's Father Brown, where the priest has to contend with a tramp, a missing donkey, and laryngitis in the church choir. At 7 p.m, there's the BBC Sports Personality of the Year, with live coverage of the ceremony in Salford. At 9, there's Sir Chris Hoy, Cycle of Hope. The Olympic and world champion track cyclist faces his biggest challenge of his life after he is diagnosed with terminal cancer. From 10:40, there's the last two episodes of Daddy Issues, with Catherine having plans to conceive and Gemma preparing a surprise birthday party. At 11:30 p.m, there's the film Bridget Jones's Baby, where Bridget, now 40-something and still viewing life through a wine glass, discovers she is pregnant. But who is the father? On BBC Two at 3:15 p.m, there's the film Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, with Elizabeth Taylor and Paul Newman feeling the strains of a family birthday party in the stifling humidity of Louisiana. At 5 p.m, there's the Hairy Bikers Christmas special, with the bikers throwing a party. At 7 p.m, there's My Epic Camel Adventure, with Gordon Buchanan attempting to cross the Gobi Desert by camel. At 8 p.m, there's Amazing Hotels, Life Beyond the Lobby, with Monica Galletti and Rob Reinder travelling to the Wilderness Hotel Inari in Lapland. This is followed at 9 by A Merry Tudor Christmas, with Lucy Worsley recreating the seasonal celebrations from the time of Henry VIII. At 10, there's Inside Number 9, with a family holiday in an Austrian village where good children get gifts and bad ones are punished. On ITV, at 2 p.m, there's episode 4 of Sarah Davis's Christmas Craft Off, featuring pom-poms, tree toppers, decoupage and gingerbread. At 8:30 p.m, there's Steve Backshall's Royal Arctic Challenge, with Steve retracing the Arctic journey from 1975 of the young Prince Charles. At 11:05 in The Accidental Tourist, Stephen Mulhern is challenged to overcome some of his fears by going to South Korea and taking a fishing expedition with free-diving mermaids, sampling raw seafood, and undergoing extreme acupuncture. On Channel 4 at 8 p.m, we're taken inside Baileys at Christmas. A bottle of Baileys is sold every 2 seconds at this time of year, and the company has high hopes for their new launch of a chocolate and orange-flavoured drink. At 10, there's the festive edition of Gogglebox, first shown in 2023. At 11:30 p.m, there's Gogglebox Stand Up to Cancer, with well-known faces commenting on TV programmes. And now to the last day, Friday the 19th of December. On BBC Two at 2 p.m, there's the Sister Boniface Mysteries, where the nun, stranded on a train in winter, finds herself caught up in a jewel theft and an impossible murder. And at 8 p.m, there's Celebrity MasterChef Final, with 3 stars going head-to-head for the coveted title. On BBC Two at 9 p.m, we have Treasures of the National Trust, from 3 National Trust properties across Britain, as teams prepare their houses for this season. On ITV at 9, there's the film Red One, a festive action comedy. After Santa Claus is kidnapped, his head of security is forced to team up with a notorious hacker on a global mission to save Christmas. On Channel 4, at 8, we have Hunting Britain's Parcel Thieves, a documentary about how the reality of Britain's stolen parcels has become big business, costing us more than £650 million. At 9, we have Celebrity Gogglebox, a compilation of the best of Series 7. And finally, Bill Bailey is in Limbo Land, where the comedian explores our expectations of happiness with his trademark wit and music. So that's my compilation of TV programmes for you for this week. I hope you find something to entertain you.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, December 13th. and celebrations of the 250th anniversary of Jane Austen's birth continues with Rachel Joyce's two-part adaptation of her classic novel Pride and Prejudice, with Tamsin Grieg as the narrator. 3:15 Saturday afternoon, Radio 4, and it concludes on Sunday at 3. Back to Saturday, Opera on 3 presents a live New York Metropolitan Opera performance of Giordano's Andrea Chenier, a production by Nicholas Joel, first staged in 1996. Polish tenor Bitor Beszala stars in the title role of the virtuous poet who falls victim to the intrigue and violence of the French Revolution. 6 o'clock, Opera on 3, Radio 3. In Archive on 4, The Battle of the Drina, filmmaker Fiona Lloyd-Davis looks back 30 years to the siege of the town of Gorazde in the Drina Valley, which took place during the years of ethnically divided warfare, which ended in the breakup of Yugoslavia. Sunday, December 14th. Lauren Laverne's guest in Desert Island Discs is Lee Child, the creator of the Jack Reacher series of crime thriller novels, who's achieved international fame. 10 o'clock, Radio 4, Sunday morning. In Christmas around Europe, Radio 3 joins partner classical music stations, courtesy of the European Broadcasting Union, for an epic 9 hours of concerts and choirs. In a spirit of celebration and joy, the first programme from 12 till 3 features music from Denmark, Austria and Spain. The second from 4 to 10:30pm, music from Germany, Finland, Latvia and the UK itself. And in C.S. Lewis, The Evacuee and the Wardrobe, Emma Freud sits down with her mother Jill to talk about the time when, as a young girl, she stayed with C.S. Lewis during the war. Jill, who died last month, reveals the huge impact he had on her life and how an old wardrobe became part of her story. C.S. Lewis, The Evacuee and the Wardrobe, Radio 4, 7:15, Sunday night. On to programmes then that are broadcast at the same time each day, all week, Monday to Friday, so same radio station each day at the same time. When I Met Jane Austen, a new 10-part series marking the 250th anniversary of Jane Austen's birth. Her biographer, Dr. Paula Byrne, asks a star lineup of guests about how Austen's work has shaped and influenced their lives and own creative efforts. And there are two guests each day. The first is writer and comic David Baddiel at 11:45 on Radio 4. The second guest is author Catherine Rundell. So, When I Met Jane Austen, 11:45, Radio 4, all week in the morning. Composer of the Week features Sergei Prokofiev in the first programme. The Soviet storyteller, Kate Mollison, explores Prokofiev's early life, his childhood in rural Ukraine, and his first operatic experiments and the teachers who nurture his creative spark. Radio 3, Composer of the Week, at 4. Also, same time, same radio station, all week, The Essay. And it continues the Jane Austen theme with accompanying Austen. Film critic Antonia Quirk speaks to composers who've composed scores for film and TV adaptations of works by Austen, plus a biopic about the Hampshire-born author. 9:45 in the evening, all week, on Radio 3, accompanying Austen. And Book of Bedtime is Mary MacDonald's Big Trip by Alexander McCall Smith. A beloved teacher's busy life has left little room for the flights of fancy, but on retirement from her school, Miss MacDonald plans the adventure of a lifetime. Let's resume with the rest of the week's highlights. Monday, December 15th. Dad's Army fans can hear an episode of the classic World War II sitcom from 1974 on Radio 4 Extra on Monday. It's at breakfast time, 7:30am, or 12:30 lunchtime, or 6:30pm. Love and Friendship, starring Victoria Hamilton and David Tennant, is a dramatisation of, yeah, you guessed it, Jane Austen's satire of teen rebellion, written when she was 14. Love and Friendship, Radio 4 Extra, 3 o'clock on Monday afternoon. And in a new 8-part series of Brief Lives, Matthew Paris is joined this week by former astronaut Tim Peake, who nominates Spitfire test pilot Geoffrey Quill. Brief Lives, Radio 4, 4pm. Tuesday, December 16th, Jim Henson will be known by millions as creator of The Muppet Show. And sadly, of course, he's no longer with us, but his fabulous creations live on. In the studios, Sean Alsop visits Jim Henson's Creature Shop in New York, where they're creating a live version of his smash hit fantasy Fraggle Rock. BBC World Service for this programme, 1:30 at lunchtime or 11:30pm on Tuesday. The new 10-part series of Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley begins with Murder by the Book. For this show, presented by this year's Hay Literature Festival, Worsley focuses on tales of nefarious women, nefarious at least in society's eyes, who've inspired characters in books. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley, 11 a.m. on Tuesday. For Radio 3 in Concert, Ian Skelly presents a concert of jazz-infused orchestral music from November 22nd at Glasgow's Royal Concert Hall, featuring Anatole Gershwin and Rachmaninoff. Radio 3 in Concert, 7:30 p.m. And as it's Tuesday, don't forget In Touch, news, views and information for people who are blind or partially sighted, 8:40, Radio 4, Tuesday night. On to Wednesday, December 17th, and Tim Harford presents a 3-part series of More or Less, the programme explaining some of the number and statistics used in everyday life. 9 o'clock, Radio 4, More or Less. In The Many Faces of Ebenezer Scrooge, historian Sir Christopher Frayling explores how Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol has endured for more than 180 years and become part of our cultural bloodstream, inspiring radio, film, TV and stage, and even adverts. First broadcast in 2016, The Many Faces of Ebenezer Scrooge, Radio 4 Extra, at 10 o'clock in the morning, 4 p.m. or 12 midnight. David Eagle, See No Eagle, is a new 4-part series in which the comedian and folk singer reflects on his experiences as a travelling folk artist, his burgeoning stand-up career and his struggles with technology and life as a blind person. 11 o'clock, Radio 4, David Eagle, See No Eagle. Thursday, December 18th, the documentary Elephant Politics reveals that according to surveys, the elephant is either our fourth most popular animal or isn't even in the top 10. What to believe? Prepared to be enlightened and alarmed as Joe Dwyer visits Botswana to look at the challenges of elephant conservation. BBC World Service, 9:30, Thursday morning. Happy Holidays is a drama inspired by real events. Backpacker Kate is on her way home to London from the US when it turns out she has inadvertently overstayed her visa by a day. She's arrested and incarcerated with hundreds of other illegals, and the struggle for her release begins. 2:15, Happy Holidays, Radio 4. And this evening's Radio 3 in Concert is Bach's Christmas Oratorio, performed on Saturday at Saffron Hall, Saffron Walden, by the Polyphonia Choir and Britain Sinfonia. Radio 3 in Concert, 7:30 p.m. Thursday. Finally, Friday, December 19th, and the afternoon drama is Limelight, Spores, a new 5-part series of the supernatural horror by Marietta Kirkbride. It's 12 years since social worker Cassie discovered a mysterious mould invisible to almost everyone. Now the fungus has spread, its glowing spores a major global health threat. Limelight, Spores, 2:15, Radio 4, Friday afternoon. And Friday night is Music Night, a gospel Christmas, a festive special recorded on December 3rd at the Watford Coliseum with no less than 2 gospel choirs and the BBC Concert Orchestra. 7:30 p.m. Radio 3 on Friday night. Finally, The Adverb. Writer, rapper and beatboxer Testament, plus guests including poet John Hegley, present a cabaret of Christmas poetry and song. Round off your week, Radio 4, 9 p.m. That's it. Thank you to Leslie for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening, and a very Merry Christmas too.
TNS Soundings.
Albion Match Report. Adam Armstrong scored twice to lift Southampton to within a point of the Championship playoffs and add to the pressure on West Brom boss Ryan Mason. Leo Cienza claimed the opener for Saints before Armstrong's first half double made it 7 goals in 6 games for the striker. West Brom rallied in the second half and Carlin Grant and Nat Phillips scored to set up a frantic finale before the Baggies sank to their 7th successive away defeat. Tonda Eckhart has now won 6 of his 7 games in charge since replacing Will Still and is steering Southampton quickly up the table. The South Coast club have found the target 21 times under Eckhart after managing just 13 in their 13 league games with Still at the helm. With the Baggies down in 16th after just 2 wins from their past 10 games, fresh questions are likely to be asked of progress under Mason, who was appointed in the summer. West Brom Academy graduate Tom Fellows showed the Baggies just what they are missing since his £10 million summer switch to Southampton as he created the opening goal. Fellows turned and ran three quarters of the pitch before finding Cienza on his right, who scored expertly into the far corner. As fluent as Southampton were, West Brom didn't help themselves, and they gifted Saints a second when Callum Stiles played the ball back to Phillips, who was robbed by Armstrong to score his first of the night. West Brom goalkeeper Joe Wildsmith then gave the ball away for Kasper Janda to shoot over before Saints grabbed their third after some intense pressing. Taylor Harwood-Bellis pounced on an errant pass and found Finn Azaz, who fed Armstrong to score with a neat finish across goal into the far corner. West Brom turned the game on its head in the second half, and Grant scored his first goal of the season with a left-footed effort. The Baggies rallied, and Isaac Price had a couple of efforts before Phillips headed home from close range, 4 minutes from time, to set up a grandstand finish. Samuel Illing Jr. came close to an equaliser, only to shoot wide in stoppage time. Ryan Mason said, "No, it's certainly not the time to do that when you're 3-0 down after the first half and the nature of why we were 3 down. I think the bigger concern, yes, in the second half, how that panned out. But football isn't 45 minutes, it's 90 minutes, and we're not good enough in that first half, certainly. There are many different things. Obviously, we've made individual errors. Having the bravery and the belief to execute something, I don't think we quite had that in the first half. Did we have it in the second half? Yes, we did. But at this level, and at any level, to come back from 3 goals down is extremely difficult."
Hello, this is Trevor reading articles from the Express and Star on Tuesday, the 9th of December. "Those selling illegal plates have got away with it for far too long." This article is by Paul Jenkins. West Bromwich MP Sarah Coombs is part of a parliamentary group calling for a crackdown on groups and individuals who supply illegal ghost number plates. Today in Parliament, she will call for restrictions on the number of licensed number plate sellers and tougher penalties for use of illegal plates by drivers. A major new report warns the UK's outdated and poorly regulated number plate system has created a vast and rapidly growing crisis that enables criminals and organised crime gangs to operate undetected on the road network, lets dangerous drivers off the hook, poses serious safety concerns, and leads to a significant loss of public funds. The All-Party Parliamentary Group for Transport Safety, APPGTS, launched the report, which will be heard today following the cross-party inquiry into vehicle registration plates. Currently, the UK has more than 34,000 number plate suppliers operating with no background checks and minimal oversight, and some with criminal records. Ms Coombs has worked with West Midlands Police on identifying vehicles which operate on cloned or illegal plates which can't be identified by automatic number plate recognition, ANPR cameras. The report also links the use of illegal plates to car cruising, which has been banned in Birmingham and the Black Country since February 2024. It recommends standardising the design of registration plates with security features to bring the UK up to international standards, and banning the use of 3D and 4D plates, as well as significantly restricting the number of licensed sellers via annual fees, regular audits, and the removal of those non-compliant. The MP said the crackdown is long overdue, with Sandwell being a particular hotspot. She said this explosive report lays bare the threat posed by ghost and clown plates and also makes clear how the whole system is failing. "Those selling illegal plates have gone under the radar for far too long, but now they've been rumbled. I hope the government cracks down on them immediately." Man is locked up for 10 years after a series of violent crimes. A 27-year-old man from Sanwell has been jailed after being found guilty of multiple sexual and violent offences. Daniel Lander of Charlemont Avenue, West Bromwich, appeared for sentencing at Mould Crown Court yesterday. Previously, he had been found guilty of 2 counts of rape, inflicting grievous bodily harm with intent, assault and criminal damage. Shortly after 8:30 a.m. on Saturday the 29th of March, North Wales police officers attended a reported disturbance at the Tamar caravan park in Abergele. Upon their arrival at a caravan on the site, Lander was arrested on suspicion of assaulting a woman. She sustained significant injuries as a result of the assault, which included a fractured eye socket and bruises to her back, ribs and arms. Lander's sexual crimes were subsequently disclosed by the victim in a police interview, during which she reported rape of offences that had occurred between October 2024 and March 2025. Following his conviction, Lander was sentenced to 10 years in prison, with a further 2 years to be served on licence. Detective Constable Catherine Farrington said the sentencing reflects the severity of the horrific offences committed by Lander. This man inflicted brutal violence on a woman, leaving her physically injured and emotionally distressed. I want to commend the victim in this case for her courage. No one wants to spoil Christmas. Fear families could be turned away after ticket fraudsters target Santa train event. This article is by Dan Stacey. A railway attraction has put out a warning after being targeted by fraudsters selling fake tickets for its Santa train. The Chasewater Light Railway and Museum Company in Warsaw became aware of an online ticket reseller was selling fake tickets for the Christmas event after numerous families arrived for the festive experience. The Burnwood-based railway has now circulated an alert on social media asking visitors to check their tickets are genuine, as most trains are now fully booked. It has also posted an image of the fake tickets online, with staff advising anyone affected to report it to their bank or as fraud. A Chasewater Light Railway and Museum Company trustee said, "No one at the railway wants to spoil Christmas, and so far we have accommodated the families who have arrived to see Santa. But this fraud has an impact on them and the railway, which is a charity, and its income from the Santa trains carries us through the closed season until Easter. We may have to turn families away if we have no seats." The railway has contacted police, who advised anyone with fake tickets to contact their banks and their ticket sellers for a refund. Future of unauthorised car dealership is cast into doubt. Owner lost bid to reverse council ruling due to site being overcrowded with vehicles. This article is by Christian Barnett. The future of an unauthorised car dealership in Wensbury has been cast into doubt after the owner lost his bid to reverse a council ruling. West Midlands Cars in Franchise Street, Wensbury, opened without planning permission in 2022 and has been the subject of several complaints due to the site being overcrowded with cars. A planning application by owner Gull Nawaz to use the site for car storage and sales was rejected in June 2023 by Sandmore Council, which said it was inappropriate and to the detriment of residents. Mr. Nawaz appealed to the government's planning inspectors in a bid to get the ruling overturned, but a review of the plans has seen officials back the council's decision. The council said it had received several complaints about cars parked on the street, and Franchise Street has been visited by several council departments as well as West Midlands Police. The council visited again in November 2023 to find that former pub's car park full with untaxed and off-the-road sawn cars and several parked on pavements and on the streets. On-street parking at these levels causes congestion as two-way vehicle movements cannot be maintained and obscures visibility for drivers leaving BB Road and Cook Street, the council added when rejecting the application 2 years ago. Many properties on Franchise Street are Victorian Terrace properties, as residents rely on the on-street parking. This business has a severe impact on residential amenity. After the appeal was lodged by Nawaz earlier this year, the planning inspector made a visit to Franchise Street and found that several cars were partially parked on the pavement, impeding accessibility for pedestrians and pavement users, and causing inconvenience and potentially highway safety issues if they were unable to pass and had to step into the road. In places, it would not be possible to pass along the pavement, in a wheelchair or with a buggy due to the presence of parked cars on the pavement. The inspector said in a report which agreed with the council's decision. The inspector said evidence submitted to support Mr. Wiles' appeal did not sufficiently explain how the business operated, the capacity of the site and how the number of cars on the site at any one time was controlled. Limited evidence has been supplied in terms of the number of vehicle movements associated with the use of how staff and customer parking is provided, the inspector said. Furthermore, the frequency and management of deliveries, including the parking and turning arrangements for any vehicle transporters or similar vehicles, has not been explained. As a result, it has not been demonstrated that the site has the capacity to provide sufficient parking and adequate space to accommodate turning requirements associated with the use. The inspector concluded that the car dealership resulted in an increased parking pressure and demand and resulted in the pressures of inappropriately parked cars and delivery vehicles manoeuvring in the highway.
To end this week's edition, I want to include a tribute to Terry Bullingham, who died earlier this month. It was Linda, who's about to read this piece, who alerted me to the fact that Terry had passed away and that his funeral took place a week or two ago in Brighton, which she attended. She knew Terry a bit through Peter Beasley, who used to be involved with the Talking newspaper until he died a few years ago. So I think it's fitting that we have this remembrance of Terry Bullingham.
The Fleet Air Arm Association. Terry Bullingham, 21st of October 1944, crossed the bar on the 10th of November 2025. Terry joined the Royal Navy in 1960, leaving in 1984 and served on several ships and squadrons. Terry's funeral took place on Wednesday, the 3rd of December, at Woodvale Crematorium, Brighton. There is a tribute page to Terry where donations are invited to Blind Veterans UK. The site is terencebullingham.muchloved.com. A piece appeared 3 years ago in the Express and Star about the Falklands War and Terry, who lived in Smethwick before moving away from the area some years ago. The Falklands 40 years on, blinded on board HMS Antrim. Peter Rhodes has met many Falklands veterans over the years, and we've reproduced interviews written by Peter 40 years ago, published by Peter Rhodes on March the 30th, 2022. The last thing Terry Bullingham ever saw was two Argentinian Mirage jets head on. It was like an air show, he recalls, at his Smethwick home. They were so slow and going too fast to register properly. Then there was a sound like calico ripping, only many times louder. It was the roar of the warplanes opening fire with their cannon shells exploding around the flight deck of the Royal Navy destroyer HMS Antrim. Chief Petty Officer Bullingham felt a sickening blow, and at the age of 37, his world went black. It was May the 21st, 1982. HMS Antrim, providing air defence for the troopship Canberra, had been struck by two Argentinian bombs, which failed to explode. Next came a strafing attack, which left a cluster of crew injured and CPO Bullingham blinded. We heard this huge metallic ring as the bomb struck. We didn't know whether it had gone off or not. We were busy cooling the decks with water. Then we saw the mirages. I was hit in the arms and leg. I remember going into the fetal position. Someone said, "You've got a couple of black eyes." And I thought, "He's lying." Terry Bullingham was relentlessly upbeat. "If you have to be blinded," he said, "it's far better to lose it instantly." It just went black. No shades of grey, no flashes of light, no anxiety. Nothing to distract your brain. Just total blackness and two plastic eyes. Now you see it, now you don't. He stayed in the Navy for 2 years after the Falklands War, working as a guide at a Navy museum. I could have stayed on, but that would have been the comfortable thing. I didn't want to end up as the old fart at the end of the mess bar. I've never had any problems with the politics of it. Think what would have happened if we'd just left it and done nothing. I'm glad I took part because the people in the Navy who didn't take part still feel guilty. But I don't think people realise how lucky we were. The Argentinians had 4 submarines and we had no idea where they were. Supposing they had sunk 3 of our ships, the whole thing was luck. The little tanks, a surprise weapon. No careless talk, no cap badges to be worn, Scott Ward recalls. We were going to be a bit of a surprise. We were going to bend their mess tins and spoil their whole day. When the balloon went up in April 1982, he was a 20-year-old tank commander in the elite cavalry regiment, the Blues and the Royals, with not a care in the world. I'd been in the army since boy service at 16, and I'd been in Cyprus and Northern Ireland, and now we were off on this 20,000-mile cruise. It was just like some great big adventure. The task force's big surprise was a detachment of 8 light Scorpion and Scimitar tanks. First ashore at the San Carlos landings, they were used throughout the fighting as mobile artillery and to carry the wounded. Because the armoured unit was so small, just 24 men, it got few mentions in the news reports and books of the war. But the Blues and Royals were in the thick of the action. The stupidest question people ask is, did you kill anyone? We did our job, and that was our job. It was a shooting war. War is all a big adventure, until you see what can happen to people. One of his closest friends, WO2 Danny Wright of the Scots Guard, was killed instantly by machine gun fire. The Blues and Royals lost 1 tank to a landmine and 2 men were wounded. Scott Ward came home with a bit of metal in my leg and served with the regiment for another 2 years before joining the police. He received 2 bravery awards in 2001 for trying to save a man from drowning in the River Severn of Bewdley. Action stations as Exocet strikes. It had been a good night for the Brits. The Falklands War was almost over. The Paras commandos and guards were closing on Port Stanley. A few miles offshore, the destroyer HMS Glamorgan was doing her bit, whamming 4.5-inch shells into the Argentinian positions above the town. As dawn broke, Glamorgan turned away. We had fallen out from action stations and were in the operations room, recalls Police Constable Anton Aggie Christie. Then we remembered we'd left our kit on the upper deck. I went to get it. I was coming back down when I felt one of our missiles being launched. You felt the ship shudder. I just stopped and thought, what's happening? And a few seconds later, the Exocet hit us. There was a huge bang. They sounded action stations, and I thought, that's a bit late. 13 of his comrades died when the Exocet, fired from a launcher in Port Stanley, slammed into Glamorgan's rear hangar. There was nothing left. The Wessex helicopter had vanished, apart from its gearbox. I saw someone lying down and realised it was a body. I knew them all. That night, there was the classic burial at sea. Someone paid the last post on a bugle, not very well, and the bodies went over the side. We were all shell-shocked. Until the Exocet struck on the June the 12th, 1982, HMS Glamorgan, known to all hands as the Glamorous Organ, had been a lucky ship. She was one of the first into action, shelling Stanley Airfield on May 1st. Able seaman Christie, just 19, was on the upper deck loading the anti-radar rockets when the Argentinian warplanes attacked. The bomb landed astern and lifted our Arsend out of the water. This aircraft suddenly shot down our starboard side and I was actually higher than the plane. If the enemy pilots were brilliant, some enemy soldiers were not so hot. Glamorgan's crew watched in horror as an aircraft was shot down over Stanley. A few minutes later, the crew got the report that the Argentinians had brought down one of their own planes. Aggie Christie recalls a slight cheer at the news. But the mood changed a few days later when the first Exocet attack of the war destroyed HMS Sheffield. That's when it stopped being a game, he says.
And thank you again to Linda for passing on news of Terry's passing. She tells me the funeral in Brighton was very well attended. That brings us to the end of this edition. I have to mention a thanks to our readers who were Mia, Jan, Gavin, Linda, Janet and Trevor. Not forgetting everybody working in the background, including Pam and Sue Clovier, picking all the articles, from whom we'll hear a little in the Christmas special, which we're very hard at work on, as we also prepare the final edition for next week, the 20th of December, of the final Talking News. But the Christmas special should be with you in the post and on the internet at that time. So I must sign off now and leave you in the capable hands of In Touch, this week dealing with blind dating. In fact, it seems it's a TV programme about blind dating. That's it then for this week. Hope you've enjoyed listening. We'll be back with the final edition for 2025 in a week's time. Bye-bye for now from all the team.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.